Tech WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. This one is going to be a spicy one, but before we get a little spicy, I haven't had a crab cake in a month. We're doing a whole month's worth of crab cake tour stuff to make up for it. All of it presented by the Maryland Lottery. Let yourself play at Silver Spring Mining this week. Councilman David Marks will be with us on Friday. We're at the Chop Tank in Fells Point. I got Tony Tochterman bringing me waders down and Eddie Lauer strumming the guitar and among other things. Next week, Wednesday, we are at Fadley's. We're going to be there for a couple of hours. I'm going to let you tell Don Moeller tell you about that. And then on Friday, we're going to be at Nick's Grandstand Grill in Timonium. I don't have any guests for that. If you know anybody in Timonium, invite him over. We'll be at the track. And then on the 17th, that's a Wednesday, we'll be at Coco's. After postponing, moving, slotting, COVIDing, we're finally going to do it, and I will, I'll have my mask on. We're coming, Marcel, I swear. We're coming to Coco's. Don Moeller, these are your favorite segments because, like, at heart, you wish you were Malia Cromer. You wish you were a pollster. You want to be a pollster. You are a fan of pollsters, a fan of political science. This is your baby, right?
Oh, man, when you get the pollster and the pundit, as we call it, you know, the founding partner of KO Public Affairs, Damien O'Doherty, and Dr. Malia Cromer, Associate Professor of Political Science, and the director of the Sarah T. Hughes Field Politics Center at Goucher College. It's always a good gab fest. And Malia, we are going to start, jump right in with you. You have become, how many years have you been doing the Goucher poll now?
We are 9 years old now. So wow. Next year is our 10th year anniversary, but we've been here since, for 9 years. It's been a long haul, but we're glad to be here.
Well, remarkable. And it's become truly one of the gold standard polls. There are polls across the nation that people look to, and everyone that cares about public opinion and what people are thinking sort of wait with bated breath every year when the Goucher poll comes out. And this year, certainly this didn't disappoint, and we're going to get into all of that. But before we do, Damien and Malia, I want to ask you, both of you, as I did, had the really, I call it an honor to be invited and to attend the celebration of life for our friend Ted Venatulwas. And Malia, you said to me before we get to Damien, who has he has enough Ted stories that we could be on all day, but you said to me when we chatted after Ted's death, I think your comment was, Don, he had been really good to Goucher. So talk a little bit about the celebration and what you meant when you said he'd been really good for Goucher.
Well, Ted sat on our board for many years. He was certainly a connection between Goucher College and the larger sort of political and business communities in the state. To me personally, he was really supportive. When I came, way back in 2012, I mean, I didn't know anybody in the entire state. I had never lived in Maryland. And Ted made it a point to come see me during like my first couple weeks at Goucher. I actually had no idea, because how naive I was. I had never been in the state, so I had no idea who he actually was and how important he was and to the state's political fabric. I just thought he was a delightful older man on our board that would seem very interesting.
So you didn't Google him. You didn't know he ran the county, almost became governor, like none of that, right?
He was just like, oh, I'd like to come see you. And I was like, okay, great. And I just thought he was a member of the board. And I had, I had just got to the state. We had a wonderful conversation. I had Googled him after and realized who I was talking to. But after that, he had always constantly checked in. Every time we released a poll, I'd get a note, an email, checked in on me just to see how the poll's doing. He was always, he's a political animal. And he was always very interested in the results. So personally, I appreciated his support. It means a lot as an assistant professor new to a college to have a member of the board of trustees be interested in what you're doing. It's a big thing in academia. So it meant a lot to me.
And hey, Damien,
I miss him terribly.
I want to ask you, when someone, we're at the end of the generations where someone of Ted's stature ran government can pass away and have everyone praise him, because making enemies is part of like the gig, right? I mean, I guess in the modern vernacular, that's the way it is. I don't want to say old fashioned in some way, but more like getting along with more people. I mean, government ran better in Ted's era, and he was a part of that, and people getting along, right?
That's exactly right. You know, one of the biggest disagreements we had was I tried to explain to some friends and clients that in front of Ted that Baltimore had some tribal elements to it in its political culture, that there were sort of different groups. And Ted said, no, that's not true. And I looked at him like he was, you know, out of his mind. But over time, what I realized is he had this like Aristotle's work ethic when it came to engaging community and progress. And that was really a conversation with him that he would have with innumerable people over and over again. And so to him, there were no tribes in Baltimore or greater Baltimore. To him, it was all one thing. And I think that's what we saw that day at Goucher's, really beautiful college. It looked just amazing that day, showing itself off for Ted and Lynn, who I think everybody saw Lynn and just thought that people were asking me, you know, would she be a good lieutenant governor? I said, let's give the lady time, you know, so...
Does it ever stop politics with you people? I mean, literally, Marla stops 5 minutes for baseball. Like, literally, you know?
Well, it's sort of what we do. I don't know.
You know what? Ted wouldn't want it any other way. No, literally, it is a memorial. He would want you guys trying to fix the stuff that's still broken, right?
Well, absolutely. Well, speaking of, and again, I think we all agree that it was just a wonderful ceremony. You know, I think I mentioned before on the show, Nestor, I loved that you know, everyone that spoke was so powerful. And I loved that Governor O'Malley, his topic was Ted, the Baltimore guy. You know, what could be more quintessentially Ted than the Baltimore guy? And you know, my wife, who's a big fan of the speaker, obviously said, you know, tell me about the speaker. Tell me about Nancy. And I said, well, you know, the interesting thing, and Lee, I don't know if you have a reaction to this as well. I said, it's interesting when Nancy Pelosi comes to Baltimore and interacts with what I'll call her peeps and gets a chance to talk about her childhood friend, Ted Venatoris. She really isn't the speaker. She's Nancy from Little Italy. I mean, talking about growing up, I thought, man, that's her power. That's her magic sauce, right? She's Nancy from Little Italy.
Listen, I think that was the vibe that day. Go ahead, Damian.
No, just going to say it's a special moment when you see Speaker Pelosi and Governor O'Malley grieving there, and you see Speaker Pelosi look to Governor O'Malley and she just said, substance. You are so full of substance always,
right.
You know, and he, you know, that was a very special moment for him at a very special time, I'm sure. And that's what Ted's all about. So a lot of those moments, I think.
And then she talks about, right, being the little IND girl, because I thought, man, we all had these experiences in high school. The little IND girl who gets invited to a party. And Ted Venatoris is with his brother and his parents are out of town. And the next thing she knows, guys are coming into the party with cases of beer on their shoulder. And the little IND girl's going, oh, you know, it's just, you could just picture that moment. So it really was a gathering of friends and family. And we miss Ted very, very much. Malia, let's jump. Ted would want us to say, all right, enough of that. Get on to Malia's poll. For those who aren't familiar, again, 9 years, hard to believe. Next year, we have to have a cake or something next year, Malia, and balloons and champagne and the whole thing for 10 years. But talk to folks about the process. I mean, you come out with this thing, you know, in October and, you know, you didn't start the day before. So take folks behind the curtain and tell them how the Goucher poll is designed, who's involved, and how do you get to this incredible finished product?
Sure. Okay. So the Goucher poll is ultimately at its core a teaching tool for our students at Goucher College. We're really big on experiential learning. It's sort of like in our DNA. And so from the very beginning, I have a team of students. They help pick out questions and design the instrument. And by doing that, I help teach students how to actually write a survey questionnaire. And so we write the survey questionnaire, and then we put it in the field. Now, for years, Goucher College had the call center on campus where students would do the calling. We have since moved away from that. And moved more into the students doing, helping with the press release and helping write op-eds on the back end and do data analysis on the back end. So now a professional call center does the calling for us. It takes about a week in the field for the calling to be completed. They send, then they'll send the finished data to me. And so I design the instrument with the students on the front end. I do all the analysis and the weighting and all that kind of like the more statistical stuff on the back end. Students help me write the press release. After we're done writing it, I send it over to communications and they correct all my grammatical errors, which there's always a lot. And then they send it back to me. The students and I give it one more once over and we queue it up then for the three-part release. We try to do the release policy first, then some politics, and then something interesting on that last final day for the one, the final pizzazz, I suppose. And that's the release or the rhythm. Right now, we're all out and we're all done. So students and I are now working on op-eds that, you know, we'll hopefully have something in Maryland Matters and our friends at Baltimore Fishbowl. And I'll hopefully be writing something for maybe the Sun or the Washington Post about some larger issues. But that's the flow of things. That's how we do it at Goucher.
Malia, I want to ask you this, because on when you said call center and how this is done, and when you said 9 years, I'm thinking 9 years. All right, it's 2021. I have a laptop here I bought in 14. It's still functioning, and I have my 2012 laptop that literally has a CD drive in it. Right? I mean, it's the one place I can fish a CD onto my iTunes if I wish to not download. Tell me, and I guess my newest phone. I got an iPhone after having a Droid. For many, many years, technology and finding people. And I would only say this to you because I know if you know, I did 30 crab cakes in 30 days in the state of Maryland. I drove down roads that were barely on Google Maps at the end of places. And these people vote. And they had CNN sucks on the front door and they had no Wi-Fi in the parking lot. And I'm thinking, how do you know if you don't watch? But access to people who aren't mainstream in whatever way, where my mother would pick up the phone in 1980 and talk to a pollster or whatever, the house phone. How do we communicate to get information these days that may have been totally different 9 years ago or even 20 years ago when you were studying this stuff, right?
Right. Well, so I mean, obviously, there's been some methodological advancements in the way we conduct survey research. So, I mean, back 20 years ago, it was mostly landline-driven samples. That's not what we do now. The most of our surveys are conducted now on cell phones. So we draw a random sample of Maryland cell phones and still some landlines, but mostly cell phones at this point. And that allows us to reach across the entire state. It's a stratified random sample, which means that we're really careful to make sure that we're calling by each of the individual counties, that we're getting a full picture of the state's geography. And then on the back end, because we ask a series of demographic questions, because we do Maryland adults, the census and the American Community Survey give me estimates of what exactly Marylanders look like. So I'm then able to wait and do some corrections for any non-response bias on that back end. Make sure that we have a full and robust picture of what Marylanders think, not just that the folks who are interested in listening to this podcast or comment on Twitter, but like your everyday Maryland residents are able to weigh in on the Goucher College poll.
How many people will never, or like me, that like would literally, I get spammed to hell when I pick up the phone, sure. It pisses me. I mean, like, this is where I am, right? And if you're emailing me, get lost. Like, so I would never do this for you or any, personal. I'm not the guy in the mall that ever wanted to fill out. When I walk through the harbor, I just don't, you know, it's just not where I am. What percentage of humans just will never give you as you believe it to be?
I'm not sure what percentage of humans are like you, Nestor.
I am. None.
No,
zero, 0.0, yeah. As Mr. Plutarski would say.
Yeah. So listen, there's a couple different techniques that you try to get around that sort of non-response bias. You know, one of the things that we certainly do on the front end of our surveys is we introduce ourselves as calling from Goucher College. That familiarity does help people kind of cue in and get them more likely to answer to at least speak to the person on the phone. Certainly, we have worked around issues about this. You know, spam callers are problems for us as well. A Maryland number is what shows up when the Goucher College poll calls you, and so that helps at least eliminate some of that.
Well, what's your percentage of people like me when you reach, you're trying to find 1,000 people, how many of those people can be reached? I'm just, that's what always freaks me out about the science of what you do, which is the people that you could never know how they're going to vote, and they show up. And how we account for them, because they swing elections in Virginia last week.
Nestor, you're asking, let me just make sure, Malia, 1 second, I want to understand Nestor's question. You're asking Malia how many people they have to call to get a representative.
No, I'm asking percentage-wise how many people like me, because I am like me and I'm not alone, that would just never participate in a long-form poll and give answers. Just because it's not because it's personal, just because I'm just not going to do it. It's not a privacy issue. It is, but it's just an issue that I'm never that. Ask my wife. I would never. I have to fill out forms in real life. Okay. I wouldn't do it.
Right.
But I'm thinking that is that half the people? Is that 20% of the people? What is that?
So listen. So we draw a random sample of Marylanders using cell phones and landlines. A response rate on a typical survey, those are the individuals who agree to participate after calling through, is like anywhere around sort of 9 to 12% is an average response rate for surveys.
There you go.
The good thing is, the question is whether your characteristic of being like, I don't want to take the survey, makes you different politically than folks who do. And that's the reason why a lot of times we're still, although people refuse to take it, you're not different on a lot of, you're different maybe because you don't want to take surveys, but politically somebody else can represent you correctly. Somebody else who meets your demographics who are just more willing to take surveys. And so despite the fact that, you know, non-response bias is a problem, response rates are certainly a problem. Surveys continue to be able to at least I think accurately capture some parts of the accurately capture public opinion. For example, the Goucher College poll in the 2020 election, we accurately estimated Trump support in Maryland as evidenced by the results of the election. That is something that some other surveys have problems doing. I'll give you another example. Surveys have been wildly accurate in terms of gauging the amount of folks who have been vaccinated. So our last survey, we actually had a real number to check our survey against. So 78% of Maryland adults were vaccinated at the time of our survey, according to the CDC. Our survey estimated precisely that 78% of adult Marylanders who we surveyed were vaccinated. So we do have these actual touch points that allow us to gauge how accurate our surveys are. So again, and I know this is like this over and over and over again, people don't answer the phones. Well, you're right. People don't answer the phones. Response rates have dropped. But despite that, we are still able to get a sort of an accurate snapshot of what folks think. And again, we're also working with different methodologies. So a lot of folks who are resident or unwilling to take a phone survey might be willing to take an internet survey. So, you know, we're working with things with, text to web pushing. We're doing that with a lot of folks. Younger folks are more likely to do that. We're working right now to build representative panels of Marylanders and other folks from different states to be able to send folks email surveys out instead of doing the traditional phone. And we're doing the mixed method approach where we're doing both all of these things into one to accurately gauge public opinion. So just for individuals' hesitancy, just to answer the survey, that's not killing the entire industry.
Now, Malia, that's the best, and I'm going to ask Damien to jump. And that's going to be a great segue, actually, into recent elections that took place. And again, as I said, when we have the pollster and the pundit, Malia Cromer from Goucher College, the director of the Sarah T. Hughes Field Politics Center and founding partner of KO Public Affairs, Damien O'Doherty, we're going to analyze what happened recently. But that is the best explanation. I want to really give you kudos of how you get to an accurate sample, even if only 9 or 10% of the people are answering. And your vaccine example of being able to check what the real data was versus what your poll indicated really, really makes that point. Now, Damien, one of the things, and I know you live and breathe this stuff, and Malia, I want to jump. There's so much in the poll, we can't do it all. But I loved day three. And you got some heat from day three. I follow your Twitter feed, and I like it because you're not hesitant to fire back at folks. I say, well, why didn't you ask the gubernatorial question this way? Or why didn't you ask, you know, always Monday morning quarterbacks. But I was struck by, and Damien, I want you to jump in, and Malia, I want you to analyze this. When I look at your question about whether Marylanders preferred a moderate Republican along the lines of what they perceive, and we can debate all day long whether Larry's Hogan is a moderate or not. Let's not get into that because that's a topic for another day. He certainly is perceived as a moderate. Your question was, do you preserve a moderate Democrat? I mean, a moderate like Larry Hogan versus a progressive Democrat. Hogan was the overwhelming choice. Do you prefer a Trump-like Republican versus a progressive Democrat? The progressive Democrat was a clear choice. I fast forward to what happened this past Tuesday, and Damien, make some sense out of all of this in terms of what Malia found to be the pulse of the Maryland voter, because you've been on this issue for a long time as well, Damien, thinking folks misread the electorate.
Well, I think people in my camp, you know, we can turn a soccer mom into a Karen quicker than anybody on the planet. And Twitter do that to you. It changes your mind that way. And I think we've got too many people that are, you know, following, as they should, a young, dynamic, woke, democratic voice on Twitter. But, you know, then they're not going to church on Sunday and listen to the grandmother, the 67-year-old African-American in West Baltimore who, you know, is the most predictive indicator, or the suburban mom in Timonium or Upper Marlboro. You know, there is such a deafness to the reality that people are facing. And I'm sure this is what Nestor's trying to get at. Is, you know, how can I get more depth out of these experiences from public opinion researching? But, you know, look, at the end of the day, the implications are real. Last week, we talked about Nancy Pelosi being in town. She had an enormous hill to climb, and she was going to have Ted Venatoulis right there with her, raising all that money for the Democratic caucus in America and in Maryland and across the country. But think about the news today. Graham Schaefer, one of the best Republican media men in the country, operates right out of here in Baltimore, Maryland. And Graham will tell you 22 seats since yesterday have been brought back into play on the Republican side for the RCC and Congress. So her very steep hill to hold the Congress just got, you know, nearly insurmountably tougher. And so what that means for all of us, whether you're the person that loves democracy but doesn't answer a poll, or you're like me and you love talking and tweeting about politics, but you only spend a couple weekends a year out there knocking on doors, people that care about democracy we are all going to have to up our game and take it to another level, which means acting more like Ted, talking to a lot of people like Ted would, being united. That's the kind of thing I think if you care about democracy and you care about America, I think the best thing you can do is double down on your local community, double down on the network around you, and just try to talk some sense that you might not be having or seeing on your device because you're spending so much time there. Try to find a way to disconnect and get back into the real community.
Well, then I want to take that and jump back to Malia. So, Malia, it's not unusual for both parties to have pollsters in and say, okay, give me some insights. Tell me what I should know moving forward. So I'm not going to ask you to pick a horse or a party in the upcoming gubernatorial race. I don't think the folks at Goucher would be high on that. But I will ask you, if both parties invited you in and they said, Malia, just come in
and talk to us about the Maryland electorate. What would you tell them that you've learned? What does your poll tell us about the Maryland electorate?
Well, I mean, I think it tells a couple of different things. If I was a Republican consultant, I would certainly suggest that I would do everything in my power not to nominate somebody who wants to closely align themselves with Donald Trump. Our polling certainly suggests that a Trump-style Republican would lose by a tremendous amount here in the state. That should come. Our poll, I don't think our poll even needed to tell you that.
Well, it's good to know Andy Harris will never be the governor of this state. Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
So, right. So what are, you know, if you look at the last electoral return, certainly even from 2016 and 2020, obviously there's a huge Democratic advantage. And then you look at Hogan's political behavior in 2018, a clear distancing from Donald Trump, purposeful distancing from Donald Trump. And it helped, I think, bolster his popularity among Democrats. And so while I don't think that the state, we're a purple state, and I also don't think that we're a progressive state, I think that we're a moderate Democratic state. And you have to appeal to Democratic voters to win. That's your path to victory.
Malia, what's the right Republican, what's the right direction number? What's the ballpark right direction number in the state of Maryland?
That's the right question to ask. Like it's been consistently above water. It has bounced around from the sort of the mid to high 50s to low 60s for the last 6 years. And so that is a number for people to keep in mind that Marylanders consistently have thought the state in its current situation is going in the right direction. But folks should keep that in mind as they're campaigning for the sort of
future. You see any people in the Democratic field that can grow into that space that you think is so attractive in the general electorate? Or do you think the Democrats have candidates like the last two cycles where they really had difficulty competing?
Listen, I'm not going to pick and choose sort of winners or who I see like out of that original bunch. I will say this, that it is pretty clear that right now somebody who can be a moderate Democrat seems to be slightly more electorally stronger than a progressive, especially against a sort of Hogan style Republican. And just to correct Don, just to really as a clarifying point, we did not call Larry Hogan a moderate on our poll. We defined a Republican candidate by Larry Hogan. So we said it.
Right. You said a moderate. Didn't you say a moderate?
No, I did not say a moderate. I said a Republican like Larry Hogan. And that's up to some interpretation what that means. But I honestly, after 6.5 years, I think the average Maryland voter knows what they think that means. And that's what matters.
I would, some of the other polling we have done over the last couple of years, I think that holding some of those progressive policy ideals is important. The state largely has supported paid sick leave. The state largely supported the increase of the minimum wage, consistently saying they'd like to see more money for education. These are all sort of underlying progressive values. But this is also a state that's concerned about their pocketbooks. And so finding a candidate balance those two issues on the Democratic side is going to be really important, particularly if Republicans are able to find another version of Larry Hogan.
Right. Well, I think we've said, and we've certainly had our friend Michael Steele on the show. If I were betting money, I'm betting that Michael is not running. But every Democratic insider that I've spoken with recognizes that should Michael Steele be able to get through a Republican primary, which is the million-dollar question, and it's one that he's trying to answer, he would be very formidable. And I think that comes through in your poll as well. I have it in front of me, and I apologize for misrepresenting that one question. You said it. One of the questions you asked along that line was a Republican like Larry Hogan or a moderate Democrat. That's the question that I thought also should set off alarm bells for Democrats, because even when presented with a moderate Democrat, it was 49% Hogan, 44% for the moderate Democrat. Now, people will point out that Hogan's a known factor, moderate Democrat is faceless, but it still, I think, speaks to what you said in that, like so many other states and the nation, we are
you know, we're stuck in the middle. I mean, Maryland voters, truly, my perception is, are you win elections through independents and those in the middle. You don't win it on either extreme. And as Damian pointed out, I think we have some evidence that you agree with that, right, Damian? I see a little celebration.
Damian, you're muted, buddy.
Thank you. I just think that so often we find the margins so quickly and we fail to realize, like Larry Hogan did incredibly well amongst black voters in Montgomery County, for example. Why? You know, why? Was it his economic message was a little more in tune than maybe where we Democrats think African-American voters in Montgomery County are? You know, I just think that we're not doing enough listening. And, you know, candidly, when the other party is tied to an insurrection in the Capitol, you know, everybody's got to think things are a little more fragile, which means we need to pay a little more close attention to what's going on around us. And, you know, if they win the House, then you have all kinds of questions about who you're actually letting into the House to govern it. It's an incredible challenge. And I think the success, it's disgusting to say, of January 6th has ramifications in Virginia. And the reason is they said they wanted to kill this presidency in the crib. They weren't being Americans about it. They said they wanted to kill it in the crib. Steve Bannon right over the shoulder of the president. They worked their damn hardest to do it, almost succeeded. And so when the president carries a 53% favorability in a state like Maryland, where he drops 13 points amongst white women in Virginia on this past election day, you know, people have to wake up and realize the stakes are much different. And that requires the game to be played at a much higher level. I talk to suburban white voters all the time because I work for corporations and they're critical in the decision making of the household all across America. But you won't find one Democratic candidate asking me what I think. You know, well, I would. And that's I've learned to accept that. But, you know, people have got to start listening more to their neighbors and less to their devices.
Damian, I couldn't agree more. Actually, I'm as soon as we're done here, I'm about to, once I read it one more time, hit publish on a piece that I've written about what's going on. And it goes directly to that. I think the American public.
Well, it was a bad week for Democrats, right? I mean, literally, in a lot of ways, right? I mean, that this 9 months from the insurrection is sort of piled up to what people believe. I mean, I've lost friendships in the last 9 months that I thought the election would sort of sort some things out. It's gotten more divisive in many, many respects.
Yeah, and my point will be, Nestor, and I'm going to jump back to Malia, and I have a question about the polling in both Virginia and New Jersey. But my point will be, if Democrats make the mistake of pinning these losses solely on Manchin and Sinema, and with the perception that had they just gotten out of the way and allowed a progressive agenda to be, you know, move through the Congress at warp speed, Democrats do that at their own peril. I think there was lot more going on, which is what Damian is alluding to. And I always say,
well, that sounds like Washington, right? Like, who cares about Sinema and Manchin? Nobody in Essex.
Correct.
Or Highland Town. Nope, nobody. Yeah,
exactly.
We had people climbing the walls of Congress like animals, and that nobody's been held responsible. I mean, it's insane.
Well, but I don't think that motivates people either, Nestor, in this sense. I don't think that. And what I mean is
accountability.
I think it's different. I think that
murdering politicians.
I don't think that affects mom and dad who are taking their kid to the soccer game or the basketball game or going to the school fair.
Well, then maybe we have our focus in the wrong place. Maybe Damian's right about that.
Well, maybe there is a bit of an absurdity to everybody, you know, trying to get an infrastructure deal. And, you know, like we're talking about months before that, America sees a total circus show. So, like, you know, like,
critical race theory changed every election in America this week, and nobody can even define what it is.
Correct. And that goes to the whole issue of messaging and communication. That's another whole show that we'll try to make sense of. Because every time, you know, my brother has this great phrase that he uses all the time, and I think he's right. He says, in politics, if you're explaining, you're losing. And Democrats are always explaining. You know, they're policy wonks. They're thinking deeply. And Republicans, know, I heard Nicole Wallace the other night, and I thought, man, did she nail it. She said, look, I was a Republican operative for many years. We would take talking points, put them in front of a Republican candidate, and say, we've done a lot of research. This is up Malia's alley. We've done a lot of research. If you say these things, it's going to move the voters. And they say, you sure? Yeah, we got the research. So Democratic operatives, her friends, will say, if I put that in front of my candidate, it's going to say, well, can you back it up? Can you show me? Can you prove that? Democrats get hung up knee deep, and Damian is smiling because we worked for some of these guys. You know, I think back to the famous phone call, Damian, where Jim Smith had us going through calendars for days to make sure before he was going to say that Bob Ehrlich never returned his call. You know, Damian and I were part of a team that wrote an iconic Maryland commercial where I'm Jim Smith, I was county executive, and Bob Ehrlich never called me back, not once. And Damian and I thought we were just geniuses. We loved the commercial. Jim Smith said, well, I like the commercial too, but I want you to go through every calendar since I've been county executive and make sure Bob Ehrlich never called. So here's Damian and me sitting in a room. Now, the point that Nicole was making, Republican candidate wouldn't have asked us to do that. He would have said, oh, I like it too. Let's go. So Democrats better get better at that. Malia, quick question, and you guys, before we get out of here, I think New Jersey and Virginia really capture the complexities of your business. When I say your business, not your college professor business, but your Goucher, Sarah T. Hughes business. In Virginia, the polls were almost perfect. The average of the polls in Real Clear Politics were almost perfect, spot on. They had Youngkin winning at 51 or 50.8, which is where he ended up. In New Jersey, the average of the polls final in Real Clear Politics was about 9 points, with Murphy about nine points up. What, as a pollster, when you all get together in your secret handshake, what happens in New Jersey where they miss it, and what happened in Virginia where they're able to nail it?
So, well, the miss, I'll say this. I admittedly have not paid that much attention to Jersey over Virginia. But again, there was some narrowing of the field. You saw that among the sort of the final polls in New Jersey as well. But yeah, so he still won. So they did, you know, it's a pretty accurate presentation of the winner, which is always a good thing. Pollsters are now hold to, there was one point in time that if you got the winner right, everybody was fine with it. But now it's like,
now you got to get the point spread right too, like in a game. Yeah.
Right. It's like gambling now, I guess, I suppose. So Virginia's a really good example of how polling was incredibly accurate. We're still refining some issues that we had in 2020. I mean, estimating sort of Republican support on polls has become a little bit more difficult. And so that's one of the things they're sort of working through. I've been lucky here in the state that it has not been such an issue. Damian, I think you have something to add to that.
I was just going to say, you know, it's not, if the polls aren't perfect, it could be a sense that there's a great fluidity in the democracy conversation in America, right? And, you know, we're advising people to find new voters, right? That's what we all got to do in our own way, not just focus on our base or try to persuade, but try to bring new people into the process. I think you saw the Republicans do a masterful job of that last time, which makes things very difficult for pollsters that use the predicate of the past to determine their samples for the future. So, you know, I would be much more, you know, I would be much less angry at the polls and much more inward looking and saying, what else can I put into this process? Whether you're on one side or the other, you know, democracy is at stake. And I think, you know, we all need to think about what extra steps we can take to listen more to the people around us.
Yeah, you know, I mean, that's a really, really good point.
As I interrupt my friend Malia, right?
No. You're actually correct. So first of all, I would also argue that the power of public opinion polls isn't just the horse race, that folks should be actually looking at some of the policy-centered questions that pollsters are asking to figure out what people actually want. And Damian's point about doing some reflection. So speaking of, like, you know, fun Twitter stuff, I saw a lot of criticism there was the Senate president in New Jersey apparently lost his election to a very poorly funded challenger. And, you know, you have this, a lot of a mocking online of this. It's like, well, the person who lost should be the one who's very, you know, who should be doing some real reflection, not sort of laughing at this underfunded upstart that beat you.
Yeah, that kind of pisses me off just in a general American sense that this, that the perception of at least two out of the three people I'm talking to, and I'm not talking about you, Malia, really believe that money wins. And that that if you don't have the money, you can't win. If you have the money, you will win. I as an American, as somebody who votes, I hope that it's not that that's not the way of the world.
Well,
that's not the way it's going to be the next 25 years, because that won't be a good thing.
You'll see those conventional wisdoms break down just as you will see the social contract break down. So the more you see the social contract break down in America, the more you will see that dynamic. One is the other.
Then you see the pushback, which is somebody who's underfunded winning, right?
And there are outliers. Exactly right. And again, I would.
I want to be the underfund guy who won. That's my guy. That's who I've been since I met Don in 81. You know what I mean? So,
and to be clear, and I use that as an anecdote, I would actually like to see somebody take a look if there was any actually outside expenditures that were put forth in that race that actually tipped the scales. I know that it's a fun top line number that the guy who won, but I'm not sure. I don't know enough about the dynamics of that race. Well, Damien, do you?
No, but it just reminded me, like, and in Virginia, I saw Terry out raising money. Nobody worked harder than Terry McAuliffe. And, you know, he might have some gaps in his campaigning, but he was just, I mean, his opponent could just pile personal dollar.
Well, I was going to say, Damien, let's not forget that Youngkin lent his campaign $20 million. I said to my wife, oh, there's a whole world out there.
I mean, there's reason number one not to vote for that. Damien, riddle me this. Was McAuliffe a bad candidate? I mean, I'm on the outside watching this, and it's not like I'm watching Fox News, but I know what they're doing, right? But I just looked at it from the outside and thought, if you can't win Virginia, you're a really lousy candidate. And I use worse vernacular than that. To me, like, when you lose that sort of – that's like in this state. If you lose to the Republican in this state, and I've met Larry Hogan now, I'll tell you, you're a bad candidate.
If it's raining on Democrats hard in the District of Columbia – you can be assured that the gubernatorial candidate in Virginia is getting awfully wet.
And don't forget that since 1999, in every election but one, in the gubernatorial election in Virginia following a presidential election, the voters of Virginia have selected a member not of the president's party. So McAuliffe winning would have actually been an outlier from what Virginia voters tend to do. Now, I would suggest to you, Nestor, that Terry made some gaffes, and we, you know, Damien and I have been, you know, very involved in campaigns over the years. And
if you make gaffes, I'll stop you right there. You're a bad candidate. If you lose, the gaffes become the reason you lost.
Not that simple. But yeah, I mean, you have a bad day. He had a bad moment. Now, would he have won had he not said parents shouldn't have anything to say? I don't know. Malia had to go back out in the field and tell us how important that is. Hey, a couple quick questions. Malia, I have a quick question for you and then one for Damien. Anything when you and your students got together that surprised you about? I mean, you tested national parks. You tested, as I said, the COVID. I mean, it was really comprehensive. It was wonderful. Anything that when you all got together said, gee, I didn't see that coming.
Well, you know, thank you for asking about the parks thing, because that is the Goucher College poll also, because we view ourselves as, like, you know, really public spirited sort of work. So we did ask, we asked Marylanders, there is a disconnect in attitudes. So Marylanders love their parks. They say they want to visit their parks. They're, like, enthusiastic about going. But when you
see, I would answer these questions on your poll, Malia. You know, you get me into asking if you want to know if I love Swallow Falls, because I did, and I'd never been there. So I'm a pro parker now. Put me down for that. poll.
Finish up.
I didn't know you asked these kinds of questions. This is fascinating.
Well, imagine if Malia and Goucher and the Field Center didn't offer this resource to the community, we'd be stuck talking about whatever Facebook or Instagram shoves down our throats in their algorithm. What she's offering to the whole community is nonprofit, shareable information and content that brings us closer together as a community. At least we're disagreeing about things in our neighborhoods, in our state, and people we know, and that grounds us. And so I'd love to see more and more of the Goucher poll, and it's exactly the kind of thing that Stuart Bainham's trying to do and MTS Patel are trying to do, which is bring a new local news source to Baltimore so that we have other things to share: restaurant reviews, baseball games, obituaries, things that bring us together outside of this very fierce conversation that's going on around us.
Malia, back to the parks.
Back to the parks, Malia. Yeah.
That was my Goucher plug.
No, I love it, Damian, and I appreciate you. Listen, so we asked about parks and there's like a little bit of a disconnect that like people want to visit parks, they like the parks. But when you talk about funding the parks, they think that Maryland State Parks receive enough funding as they are. And that's absolutely not true, because over the last couple of years, because of the pandemic, we've seen this explosion in visitation rates. And there's been several reports out from the Maryland Park Service that they are underfunded. And, you know, to keep these pristine, beautiful public resources available for the next generations, we need to invest money in them. And I know I shouldn't be getting on my sort of like public
part. You tree hugger, you know?
You can see behind me, like I'm a big parks fan. But two of my students wrote a beautiful op-ed about it, and it'll be in Maryland Matters in the next couple, next week or so.
Oh, that's terrific. The other thing, Malia, and I know we're running over, but the other thing is I'm fascinated by this whole discussion, because it's taking place nationwide about, are we going to get back to normal? Are we in normal? Is there a new normal? And you tried to poke that bear as well. What did you take away about where people feel about what's normal and whether we're going to be normal?
So we had this question back in March. And if I would add, back in March, folks thought like right about now-ish is when we should have been getting back to normal. But unfortunately, the Delta variant and that summer surge has really derailed a lot of things for folks. And so we asked people again in October, and now it's sort of like looking out into the future. We're talking at least 4 months from now. Two of my other students just wrote about this topic as well. And I think that we are submitting it to our friends at Baltimore Fishbowl. So hopefully that will be run in the next week or so as well. This is great. Thank you for asking about that, Dawn. I've had like two great student op-eds right now in the queue on these very topics.
And just so people know, we didn't green room this. Well, and Nestor, as I said, it's always a lively session. Damian, we can't let you run. Give us an update on the Baltimore Banner, man. It's exciting. Stuart Bainham and, you know, with the memory of the Ted Venatorius Institute.
Yeah, I mean, we went as news consumers and news readers here in Baltimore, we've seen a dearth of coverage. We've seen some Pulitzer Prize winning coverage from the Sun, but we've also seen them lose and attrit a lot of staff. And you have a bold new venture that's getting national news coverage from all the very interested people in the journalism community. And I think you're starting to see the Baltimore Banner talk to more and more Baltimoreans. As you know, they did a ton of conversations with Ted and Stuart and people all across the region. But this thing is a serious operation, bringing the managing editor of the Los Angeles Times to Baltimore to locate a 100-person newsroom in downtown Baltimore, where vacancy rates are struggling. So it's a really promising time for local news in Baltimore. And, you know, I think the only way this thing succeeds is like the Ravens succeed, which is it's got to be everybody's team. And so, you know, the Banner is something I think we can all get behind or get under, as we did in kindergarten down there at Malia's favorite place, Fort McHenry. I think Baltimore can unite around this thing, because it's going to be about real local news. It's going to be about Baltimore. And, you know, Baltimore is the greatest story in America. My friend Martin O'Malley put on the benches. It's the greatest city in America. I think he's almost right. I think it's the greatest story in America. And the Baltimore Banner is going to prove that to the world.
Damien O'Doherty, our guest from KO Public Relations, as well as Malia Cromer from Goucher and doing polling. Don Moeller, of course, from our Baltimore County Executive. Don, I'm wearing my State Fair shirt. 30th anniversary is December 13th. The Baltimore Radio, we're going to kick it off on the 9th at the Beaumont. We're going to open the Beaumont a little early and hang out at the bar there for the holidays. And we're going to be doing some holiday-oriented stuff. The Maryland Crab Cake Tour. It's heading out on the road as well, and that'll be a part of that at the Beaumont on the 9th, but we're going to be next week on Wednesday at Fadley's. Don, who are our guests at Fadley's on Wednesday?
Well, we're still working on it. We're hoping to get Attorney General Brian Frosch. Brian's trying to clear his schedule. We're going to have former gubernatorial candidate Ben Jealous is joining us, and recently announced stepping down from the bench, one of Damien O'Doherty's closest friends, the former First Lady of the state of Maryland, Katie O'Malley. Katie's going to join us and talk about her years on the bench and her outstanding resume and what that might mean.
Also, on Friday, we're going to be at Nick's Grandstand Grill up in Timonium. And then on Wednesday, the 17th of November, we're going to be at Coco's, finally, after postponing and moving it along with our mayor, Brandon Scott. I am Nestor. We are WNST, AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore, and we never stop talking Baltimore positive.